Welcome to Fundraising Stories with Female Founders. I'm Julia Elliott Brown, the founder and CEO of Enter the Arena. I'm a serial entrepreneur and an expert in raising investment and business growth. Our mission at Enter the Arena is to empower female founders to fly through pre-raise and investment and onto the exponential growth of their business with investment expertise and business coaching. Here we share the stories of inspirational female founders who've raised investment to inspire you to do the same. You'll hear their honest accounts of what it was really like to secure funding, the highs, the lows, and the challenges they experienced on the journey. And along the way, we'll discuss top tips for how you can be successful too. Today I'm speaking with Gail Harrison, the founder of Untagged. Now, Untagged is a gamified fashion resale platform that launched in February this year, 2022. It's essentially an app where you can upload your old clothes that you no longer want, turn them into tokens, and then trade them for other pre-loved clothes that you do want. And not only does it save you money, but it can also track how much carbon you save, and you can be rewarded for being sustainable. Now, Gail is an expert in consumer behaviour change with a stellar career behind her, as well as a PhD in chemistry. Before she launched Untagged, she developed and launched brands for global FMCGs, including Heineken and L'Oreal. And now, having made waves in the drinks and beauty industries, she is turning her hand to fashion. Gail has to date raised around 200K in investment and is currently raising another fundraising round. So I am intrigued to find out what made Gail take the leap on this new venture and how her fundraising journey has gone so far. So welcome, Gail.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Great to see you. Okay, so big question. Why fashion resale? What made you want to go into this whole new sector?
I think there were a few things that sort of happened at the time. So I wanted to leave my job. I'd gone straight through from university, then I did a PhD and then straight into work and worked my way up through these sort of corporate ladders. And it sort of got to a point when I was approaching 40. I just thought, actually, I don't really want to be doing this anymore. It didn't feel like I was really sort of learning very much anymore. And maybe I'd sort of reached the peak of where I thought I was going to get to in these big businesses. So it felt like it was time for a change, and a few things sort of aligned to help that decision along the way. And fashion resale was something that I personally was becoming more and more interested in. Well, the truth is I had a fashion shopping habit problem, you could call it. I was just buying too much stuff and starting to feel like this is getting out of hand. I need to do something about it. So I'd started trying to use fashion resale sites like eBay and was just rubbish at it. I was buying things and getting them and they weren't right, they didn't fit, or they were just terrible. I'd spend hours on there and never get anywhere with it. I just thought there's got to be a better solution to this, and I thought I'd go away and make it.
Wow, amazing. I mean, actually, it's quite a common story, I think, that I hear from women that sort of who have been in that corporate world and then take that leap when they're around 40. It's really interesting. I mean, the average age of an entrepreneur is, I think, around 44, 45. So I mean, we have this impression, don't we, that kind of all these entrepreneurs are super young, and actually, it's not really the case.
And I wonder on the women thing if that ties in with family, because certainly for me, I mean, I at that point I adopted a little boy and really knew that I needed to be able to have quite a flexible working arrangement to settle him in. And, you know, I mean, you do anyway as a new mother, but I think probably even more so when you're adopting, because you just don't quite know how things are going to go. And the business I was working in at the time was not offering any kind of flexibility. And I'd been there for a really long time, was in quite a senior position, but it was kind of like, no, you need to move and live in a foreign country and you need to be full time, and just wasn't going to work. So I just thought, right, that's the time. That's what I need, actually, to give me the push to leave. Yeah. So it's interesting you say it's women around 40. I wonder how much of it is due to that.
It's so common. It's the corporate world's loss, actually, and the entrepreneurial world's gain, because we're getting so many incredible women who are taking that leap. So well done for making the leap. It's not easy. So tell us a bit more about Untagged then. How did you, so you had this idea, or you recognised that there was a problem. How did you then develop it and take it through to kind of getting it off the ground?
It's evolved a lot over that time. So the idea has changed significantly, I would say. So in the beginning, the idea was, we're all sitting on these huge wardrobes of stuff, and a huge percentage of what's in our wardrobes is not worn. So the original idea was about, could we find ways to sort of create these shared wardrobes where we would kind of lend clothes to each other in our communities and sort of get as much use out of what was, we have so many things that we sort of save for special. Well, why don't you let somebody else wear that some of the rest of the time? So that was sort of the original idea. And then COVID hit and people were like, I'm not sharing my clothes with anybody. And then it sort of evolved a bit more into more of a resale platform. And what I'd found out was, I guess there were sort of two or three sort of key things that were holding people back with using resale platforms. One was that they're really sort of transactional and boring. So if you think about eBay, and people talk a lot about sort of doom scrolling on eBay, that before you know it, an hour has gone and you've still not got anywhere. And actually, all the sort of resale sites that are out there are still structured in the same way as eBay. eBay was launched 30 years ago, and the market hasn't really changed the way that they do it. So there was a bit around, well, there must be a way to make this more fun and interactive. And then the second thing was this financial burden that people have with shopping secondhand, that we're so used to when we shop new that we can return things for free and people will just overorder and then return what they don't need. But with secondhand, you generally can't return things. So people worry about the money that they might waste on buying things. So we wanted to see if there was a way to just take money out of the equation. And then this whole idea of tokenizing our assets, essentially. So using a sort of system that's like a barter system, like an old fashioned barter system, but we've sort of advanced it from a tech perspective, so that your clothes become the currency that you use within the platform, was a nice way of sort of taking the money out. And then the whole thing evolved around how do we make it fun? And then we came around sort of gamification and sort of, turning the whole thing into a game in the way that, if you think about things like Fitbit or Strava, how they've gamified exercising. So you've got this group of people that know that they should exercise. They want to do it. They know it's good for them, but still find it really hard. So let's make it fun and get you to complete challenges. Same thing with resale. We've got an active audience that want to do it, but they find it hard and boring and start it and then stop. So let's make it fun. So that's sort of how it's evolved over the last couple of years.
Great. I love that. I can imagine that would really appeal to a lot of young people. I mean, if you take the kind of the money out of the equation, though, how do you commercialize that as a business?
Yeah, so our business model is very different to existing retail marketplaces. So normally you would pay a fee on each transaction, either paid by the buyer or the seller, and we don't charge any commission. So it is literally free to use. But we've turned to the sort of gaming world because we are a gamified platform, where you can, those in-app purchases, essentially. So our in-app currency, you can top up your token balance if you haven't earned enough or you don't want to play the game, you just want to have the tokens there and there, so you can buy those tokens. And there are a number of other ways we're looking at other revenue streams that sort of revolve around brand partnerships and in-app advertising, but really looking to the gaming world rather than the sort of eBay marketplace world as to the different revenue streams.
Yeah, very clever. So building the marketplace and then commercializing it once you've got that. Amazing. So, okay, great idea. Love the way it works. So let's talk about funding then. So right at the beginning, I know you did a friends and family round. Tell me what that was like.
Oh God, it was horrible. It's the worst thing, isn't it? Having to go out and ask your friends for money. I mean, it was, so I was lucky. When I left my business, I got a redundancy payout. So that was a key thing in giving me the nudge, and that from a financial perspective, I had a little bit of security. So I didn't need to go and get a job initially, and I could work on this full time. So that sort of ticked me over for a little while, but it soon goes. So it was like, okay, I need to get a bit of money behind me to be able to build some kind of platform. And we were building a white label platform, taking tech that already existed. So it didn't cost a lot. And I mean, the reality is I don't come from a family with lots of money. So asking parents for money was really hard, and I'm literally tapping into their their retirement fund. And they've been amazing all the way through, and they did put some money in. And then sort of trying to find out who else can help. And it was a really small group. So I think there were four investors in total at that point. And we raised just under 50K, which, you know, you hear all these people raising millions through their first friends and family round. Yeah, oh my God. So it was 50K that we had, which I managed to eke out for about 18 months. I mean, really being careful and thinking about how you can sort of do things really cleverly. So they were brilliant, but all the time you're sort of thinking, I've got to be able to get them their money back. This is such a risk that they've taken for me. And over the course of the last 2 years, there've been so many times when I thought the business was going to stop. You know, COVID hit and you're like, oh, we're never going to get this off the ground during COVID. And then you just manage to get through it and raise a bit more money. And then the next sort of stage comes, and each time it's like, oh no, they're never going to get their money back. And actually, when it's investors that you don't know, that becomes much less, well, for me, it's become much less of a concern. But when it's people that you see all the time, it's just, oh, I really didn't enjoy that bit at all.
Really, really personal. But I guess they wouldn't be backing you unless they believed in you.
Well, there's a bit of that, but also they wanted me to do something that they could see I was really passionate about. So my parents don't care if they get that money back, really. Mm. They've done it to invest in me and to show support. But the friends, you sort of think, oh no, I really need to get their money back.
But it's so tough, isn't it? You know, those thoughts that, is the business going to make it? Am I going to let everyone down? I mean, again, that is so, so common on the entrepreneurial journey, that roller coaster we all talk about. You know, all these big businesses that you see out there, they've all been through that at the start. You know, but that's where your entrepreneurial resilience and determination kind of kick in, isn't it? And you just will not let this thing go.
The resilience thing has been the biggest sort of awakening for me, is that, you know, you think about what you think you need as an entrepreneur going into it actually ends up being quite different. And for me, the resilience bit has been the most important thing. And I've always known I'm resilient, but I didn't realize the extent to which that was going to really come to the fore during this journey. Has been the most important thing that I've been able to lean on, is my own resilience through it.
Great. So that initial kind of 50K, how far did that get you?
So we got a platform off a website off the ground. So I'd managed to find a website that did a similar job, so would enable us to sort of test the tokenization of things, and none of the gamification at this point. Actually, it was a quite basic marketplace, but enabled us to swap clothes with tokens. So it enabled me to get that off the ground, but that was due to launch in May 2020, which we may now remember as just as lockdown happened. Yeah. And I had no choice. I had to go, had to launch it, because I couldn't afford to wait. Literally, I needed to launch it, get some data and use that to go and raise my next round of investment. So I couldn't wait 6 months and see what happened with the pandemic. Just had to go for it. And it didn't help, for sure. I mean, we managed to get some data that did enable us to then go on and raise, but it certainly wasn't what we expected it to be, and what it might have been had COVID not happened at that time. Mm-hmm. So we got some sort of proof of concept, a bit more information on that, and basically took that to go and raise more money. And real sort of serendipitous part of it was, along that journey, I came across a software company called SimpleWeb, who we now work with, who invest in early stage businesses, and they really liked the team, well, me, I suppose, and they really like the tokenization idea, but they're like, this needs something more, the idea needs something else, we think we can really help you with this. And actually, it was working with them that the idea evolved into the whole game and gamification sort of strategy. So we were very lucky that we met with them, and they're the ones that have really sort of catapulted the whole idea forwards.
Yeah, great tech partner, and we're big fans of SimpleWeb here.
Yeah.
And it is amazing, isn't it, when you get a company like that who will back you as well as provide great tech support. So good choice. So were they your only investors that came in on that next round, or did you have other people too?
No, so they, So actually, there was a bit of a mini round in between. So they put some sweat equity in, I suppose, to help us develop the concept that we then took out to raise investment off the back of. And at that point, I then started talking to everybody. So I'd sort of honed in on VCs that, you know, the limited number of VCs that say they do pre-seed investment. Very debatable what they really mean by pre-seed, but anyway. So started on that sort of journey and started talking to potential angel investors. And I mean, that was just a baptism of fire. I mean, I had no idea what it was going to be like to speak to a VC. I mean, you know, I come from 20 years of business doing big presentations to very important people, but the whole VC thing was a completely new experience for me. And I'd gone into it with a very naive outlook, I think, about what would get investment and what level of investment you could expect to generate and what valuation you could expect to get for your business. I mean, it really evolved and took about a year for investment to come in. And over that time, lots of things changed about, you know, I had to change my business proposition. I had to change how much I thought I was going to be able to raise. You know, it all moved as the conversations evolved over the course of that year.
Yeah. So it sounds like a lot of learning on the job over that year.
I think if you've never done it before, it must happen to everybody. I mean, I had a business partner at the time that did have some experience of raising investment, but it emerged that he had experience of raising investment for quite well-established businesses. So he'd never really gone in to raise pre-seed investment. And it's really hard because you've got to sell a vision, and you're going to get so many pushbacks on that vision. I mean, I have pushbacks for so many different reasons that I hadn't anticipated. I thought, you know, I'd sort of got data to support this and I'd done my research and, you know, the story made complete sense. How could anybody challenge the story? But they do. And actually you realize that a lot of the decision making is an emotional decision, not a factual decision. And I wasn't expecting that. I thought, no, I know how to present data and that's what I've done for 20 years, but actually didn't really matter in the end. They were buying into me or the vision or whether they just were interested in that area or not. So it was quite a surprise.
Yeah, I imagine a baptism of fire. And I think, again, I mean, I get it's a very common story. And I hear it from, you know, we work with female founders at Enter the Arena all the time, where people have kind of spent a year kind of doing it and learning, sort of making lots of mistakes along the way. And actually, you know, I'll be quite honest now, I think it's better if you can get the right kind of support as soon as possible to help you shortcut some of those things or all of those things if possible. Because like you say, I mean, no matter how experienced you are, it is a whole new world, like understanding how investors think, you know, the language that they speak, what they're looking for. There's a lot to get your head around.
Yeah. And I mean, you sort of know that, you know, ideally you have this sort of founding team that there's a few of you and, you know, somebody will have some business experience and somebody will have some startup experience and you bring together all of that. And you know, that's what generates success. But you can't just pull a co-founder out of thin air. So that was, you know, that was the big thing that I was told all the way through that raise, was that you won't get investment as a solo founder, particularly as a solo female founder. You have to have a co-founder. Right. I was told this time and time and time again.
Who was telling you that?
Investors were telling me that. Or actually, at pre-seed, when you would fill in a form, you couldn't even get past certain stages unless there was more than one founder. And so the problem with all of that is I really started to doubt myself, because I actually know what my own I know now what my own capabilities are, and it would be great to have a co-founder, but I haven't got one. But that's not going to stop me. I can do this without a co-founder if that's the way it has to be. But at that point, I really thought, oh my God, maybe they're right. Maybe I just can't do this by myself. And it is too hard. And the only path to success is to have a co-founder. So I spent so much time trying to find one. And I'm always on the lookout. You know, as part of your networking, there's always things that might come up. And in the end, I did end up working with somebody who, he wasn't really a co-founder, but he was somebody else on my pitch deck who could go along to meetings with me and was really interested in what I was doing. And he had some startup experience and was quite in a, you know, it was a bit, little bit older than me. So, you know, we were this really experienced founding team. And I'm not convinced in the end, actually, it made that much difference, but it got us through the door. And it was really frustrating because just having this other person there who happened to be male just meant that so much of the conversation got deferred to him. Mm. And I just like, I'm the founder here and I've got a load of experience. I have a PhD, you know, I'm a clever person who knows what I'm doing. But there was just this sort of automatic reaction to sort of deferring to the man on the team. Mm. And emails would be sent only to him, not even copying me in. And you just, what is this?
Blood is boiling hearing.
It's so infuriating.
So funny. But this is the kind of gender bias that we face. And it's effing bullshit. I'm sorry. It drives me nuts. Because there's those assumptions that are made about you as a female founder and as a woman that you're not capable. And it's also BS about the whole thing about having to have a co-founder. I mean, really, there are tons of examples of successful entrepreneurs that are solo founders. I do agree that you need to have a good team around you, but often at the beginning, you haven't got the resources to build that team. So raising investment is part of being able to put that in place. But it's that what you just said also, this chipping away where you then start to doubt yourself and you start to feel less than and lose your confidence, then makes the whole thing for female founders become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because guess what do? Oh, you go and find a co-founder who's a guy to help, you know, so it drives me nuts. So investors listening to this, please, this has to stop. You're so capable, Gail.
Well, and now actually, so now I've gone beyond that and did raise that round of investment and took the decision to not continue working with my business partner because I could see that actually he wasn't the right fit for the business and we weren't working that well together. And I believed at that point, I've got some money, I can do this. And now the conversations I'm having with investors, the solo founder thing isn't coming into the equation. And what they're saying actually is that they're really impressed by me. Okay. Like, oh, that's interesting. You weren't impressed by me when I came around a year ago.
What's the shift then? What's the shift that has made them think differently about you?
Well, I think, so partly we're still going. So we have bucked the trend and we've raised a bit of investment and the business is still going and I've built something and I'm still here, still banging on doors. So that there's a certain amount of sort of resilience there. And I definitely think I've grown in confidence through the whole process. I mean, I'm 2 years in, I do know my stuff. I can talk a good game around my business. And, you know, I've tried the co-founder business partner thing and I know that it wasn't adding any value. So now I believe that I don't need to do that. And also I am now I have got a bit of money. I have started to build a team. So I actually have two amazing women. So we're a full female founding team now. I have an amazing CMO, an amazing CTO, two women who really love what we're doing and are really experienced. And it just, we feel powerful. You know, we're like, we can do this. We can show them. And actually, one of the investors I'm talking to at the moment, it's a blockchain company. What they're particularly interested in is that it's three women in blockchain. And you're like, God, that's a turnaround, isn't it?
That's in your favor. Interesting. Yeah, but that confidence piece, isn't it? That when you exude confidence, then people are confident in you. That shift is really amazing.
Yeah. So how do you do that? I mean, that's so, because that for me is is what I think, and this is a massive generalization, but what I think men are really good at is exuding that confidence and that belief and the vision. Whereas I think, certainly me, I want to be able to prove what I'm saying and have hard facts and data. And actually, no one really cares about the data. What they care about is this an amazing, do I believe in this amazing idea and that you can make it happen? So, you know, what I'm at the moment in an interesting situation where we have some data, but not lots of data. And that becomes a really tricky spot to be in, because you start off raising money with no data. And actually people buy into the idea and think, well, this sounds quite good. Come back when you've got some data. And then you go back with some traction. But then it's like, oh, but it's not enough traction. Mm-hmm. You're like, you just can't win. You know, when is the best time to go out for investment? Is it with a bit of data or with no data? Or are you expected to just wait somehow miraculously until you have loads of data? I mean, but you can't do that.
It's partly about finding the right fit, isn't it? I think there are those people that will be prepared to invest in your idea stage and will buy into that. And the further along you get, as you say, data does become more important. When you start to get up to a kind of Series A level, when you're raising like 3 to 5 million, it's all about the data, you know, because then it's about churning a sausage factory machine, put money in one end, money comes out the other. But yeah, that bit in the middle, it's that kind of little grey area. So you know, and that is the classic response from people: come back when you've got more data. But it usually means that they're just seeing some risk and they're not convinced yet. And actually, it's usually not really about the data. It's usually about something else. And that's the hard thing, I think, for founders to dig underneath and find out why.
Yeah.
But getting that confidence early, I mean, I get, you know, it is interesting, isn't it, how us women need different things to give us that confidence. And I think it's about, we want to feel armed. We want to feel like we've got all our ducks in a row. Like you said, data, we want to have a shit hot pitch deck. We want to have the most amazing financial forecast. We want to have it all really good. In my experience, sometimes with women, actually, it's just having the right people around you that say, you are good and this is brilliant and you should go for this. And that sometimes can be the pivotal thing that can lift you from being unsure to being like rock solid.
Yes. Yeah, getting to that point where you can have a team around you or you found the right advisors to advise you.
Because if you're going, when you go into fundraising with any kind of self-doubt inside you, it just shows up in all sorts of ways. You know, so that self-doubt needs to be worked on before you can be really ready. And yeah, I think often us women need to work on it a bit more, mostly just because we've been conditioned from the minute we were born about how to behave, what to say, how society thinks about us. You know, there's a lot of unraveling to do there that isn't our fault, but we have to unravel it.
Yes. And unfortunately, it seems that the expectation is that we do the unraveling, yes. Not that the people we're speaking to might think differently about what they're hearing from a woman. Once again, it's all down to us to behave in a different way, or, you know, to present ourselves in a different way.
Yeah, I agree. It's very frustrating. I mean, I think it's about stepping into your power. It's not being somebody you're not, but it's just making sure that the best of you shines through. And the more progressive investors are trying to meet halfway, we have to do that. But there's some simple many simple things. You know, I see all the time networking events that are set up in central London in the evening over beers, and every time I will go back to the organizer and say, why are you doing that? Because most women I know who are founders, that doesn't appeal. We can't do it. We've got families, we've got stuff to do. Make it during the day, because we're working and we want to network, but it needs to be, you know, at 10 o'clock after we've dropped the kids off at school. Of course, not all female founders have kids. And of course, male founders have kids too. But there is we all recognise that as women, we tend to pick up the lion's share of those family responsibilities.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got a long way to go. We could talk about this for hours. So you got that second fundraise. I mean, how did you find those angels in the end? Because you said, oh, I speak to everybody, but what really worked for you?
In the end, it was a bit of luck, which is what I think always happens. So there were two things that happened. One is we got a VC that wanted to invest. So at the time we decided we were going to raise 250, I think, and they were going to put that in. And I went quite far down the line with them. And that was quite useful to actually be able to, when talking to other investors, I've got a VC that wants to invest and they're going to put 250 in. In the end, I decided not to go with them because they wanted to take too much. So we were going to have to sort of basically give back a significant proportion of the raise into paying to use their workspace or paying to be part of their accelerator. And you just think, this is bullshit. This is a pre-seed investment. And actually, I think I did the sums and it was something like 40% of the money was ultimately going to go back to them in all these different fees and ways that they were subject. And some of those things would have been really useful, but actually what I needed was the hard cash to go and build a platform. So I decided not to go with that investment. And then there was another angel who I'd spoken to literally the first, a friend who works for family office, who I'd spoken to when I first set up the business like a year, 18 months previously, who'd been really nice, but was very clear that this is not the sort of thing the family office invests in. So I never saw her as an investor. And then all of a sudden she came back and said, actually, I've remembered you. And if you're still going, I'd really like to talk to you about it. And then very quickly that turned into investment money. So I think, I mean, that's such a huge learning, is that you never know when a conversation is going to turn into something. I had completely discounted that. I mean, she wasn't even on my list of people to go and approach again. And then it just came back around. And ultimately I got lucky. I mean, there was a shitload of other stuff I tried that led to absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, angel meetings and angel platforms and God, all this stuff that literally came to nothing. And all the VCs, other VCs, but it was the right decision to walk away from the one VC that was going to invest and to just scale it all back and just do it the way I wanted to do it. And now we're going back out and trying again.
Yeah. It's tough, isn't it, knowing which way to go?
Hard walking away from money. I mean, that's a really hard decision. Yeah. But ultimately, it was just, they just wanted too much. And part of my downfalls is that for me, fairness is really important. And ultimately, I just didn't think it was fair. It just didn't feel right.
You've got to have a good gut feel about it. So with this raise then, what sort of size raise are you hoping for this time?
So we've gone out trying to raise 750. I think always when you're going out and raising, you end up having a number of different options. So all the way through, I've had sort of two decks, the big raise deck and the small raise deck. You sort of decide which one you're going to use with different investors. So we've gone out raising 750 and actually started off talking to VCs again. So I got some really great intros straight in with VC, so not filling in forms online or sending them pitch decks that I just don't think do anything. Direct introductions to these VCs. And there was a lot of interest at the start in the idea. Like, this is really different. The gamification is really interesting. Tokenization is really interesting. We sort of turned the proposition into much more of a tech play. So really starting to understand where blockchain would play a role and making that a sort of more central part of our proposition. So there was a lot of interest in all of that. But ultimately, it was just not quite enough to get us over the line. So, you know, the first 3 or 4 months, I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to raise this money. No problem. It's going to be done just like that. And, you know, we're going to get a couple of VCs who are just going to put the whole lot in. And then none of those happened for various reasons. But generally just that they liked the idea but needed a bit more comfort that it was going to work. So product market fit, they needed more information on that. So now we're taking a different approach, which is, okay, what we need is angel investors. So what VCs will say to you is, what you need is angel investors. Yeah, thank you for that. That's I know.
Somebody else take the risk. Come to us when you've got it all sewn up.
Give me your network of angel investors and I'll go and convert them.
Yeah.
And the other conversation we've been having is with a blockchain company. And it looks like a combination of those things is where the money will ultimately come. But trying to raise angel investment is, at least with VCs, it's very visible who they are. You can find an email address, you can find a name, you can network through LinkedIn, you can find a way in. But with angels, you're on your own, really. There are lots of platforms you can use to supposedly to support you, but I've not found them to be useful at all, actually. Just very, very frustrating.
It is very frustrating. And there are lots of angel investors, and it's like, how do you find them? Where are they? You know, there's networks, there's crowdfunding platforms, there's angel syndicates. It's about, you have to just get really good at networking and really effective at connecting with those people who are most likely to be a fit. But not easy.
It takes a really long time. And actually, I was listening to some of your previous podcasts that, ideally you start that journey before you're raising, which means that you're always raising.
Most of us founders don't appreciate that when we start our business. We don't realize that fundraising is actually one of the most important things you ever do as a founder. And so, like you said, you're always fundraising. So you need to find a way to kind of like, A, get good at it, but also B, enjoy it if you can. I know that sounds really weird. but if we spend our time kind of going, oh God, I hate fundraising. Oh God, I've got to do it again. You get into that negative mindset about it. So again, it's really important to kind of see fundraising in a different light if you can, and think, gosh, I'm really excited about going out and telling all these people about my business. And
number 450. Yeah, I can't wait to get out there.
exactly.
But the whole angel thing is, it's hard to find them. And then the reality is that generally they are men. Mm-hmm. And helping them to sort of understand what the opportunity is, I found to be really hard. The category that we're playing in, it's a fashion resale business. Much as we talk about it as a tech business, ultimately it comes back to, it's still about clothes, isn't it? And then the typical response from everyone I speak to is, well, my girlfriend this. Your girlfriend is one person. And you can't base a decision on a conversation that you've had with one female. This is what I find really, really shocking, actually. So my background, I worked for a long time in beer companies as a marketeer. So my target market was not me. It was invariably sort of 18 to 24-year-old men. And I didn't make a decision based on, well, I know I've got a husband, I'll ask him what he thinks. I made a decision based on talking to 18 to 24-year-old men. And that would inform what we did. And the same with this business. I mean, I'm not strictly the target for my business. I have a passion for it, but we're going after young women. We call them conscious fashionistas. And I know what they want because I've spoken to a lot of them over the course of my journey. And this is what I'm telling investors. We have spoken to a lot of people. And then they just dismiss that and say, well, but my girlfriend uses Vinted and she's perfectly happy with it and tokens will never work. And, they're not interested in games. Yeah.
Ah! Angel investors are investing their own money, and they will typically invest in things that they know, and they will invest in people that they recognize. So pattern recognition. And that is another thing that makes it so very hard for women, and especially when you're building a business which is for a target market that they can't relate to. So you might get lucky if they say, oh yes, my daughter, is always blah, blah, blah. And so it is really difficult. And you have to be clever about finding a way to connect with them emotionally, to help them step into the shoes of your target customer. So you have to get creative on that front. But it's really hard. We need more women investing.
Yes. And then the women that do invest tend to be more cautious. So you know that's the problem, is that, you know, we are at that. I mean, it's always risky investing, but we're particularly risky at pre-seed, early seed stage, and women, you know, just get a bit scared off at that point, I think. And it's trying to find female investors who are open to investing that early, and so the pool just keeps getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah, it's not easy. All right, so if you could go, I mean, looking back at your fundraising journey so far, if there's anything you would change about it, what would you have done differently?
I think I would have focused much more on sort of the visioning piece. So really selling. I saw something the other day about sort of big, hairy, audacious goals. And I think that's a really nice way of thinking about it. You know, sell. I mean, also been watching the WeWork dramatization on Apple. And you know, Adam Newman was brilliant at this, much as whatever you think about the guy, he was brilliant at selling this amazing vision and obviously raised loads of money off the back of that. I think I probably haven't been good enough at that piece. I've been too sort of, you know, data led, and you know, I'm a scientist. That's unfortunately, you know, my thing. So maybe sort of focusing a bit more on that. And I think sort of, so now I've got a team that supports me, and we've got this really strong team. If there'd have been any way we could have got that together at an earlier stage, I definitely think that would have helped, because we are strong, and I think people, we are very investable now as you know, these three strong women who really know what we're doing.
That's good advice, actually. I think for all founders, even if you can't afford to pay people just yet, if you're raising a round and you can identify the people that are going to be on your team and those people have committed, or you can find a way to remunerate them in other ways or defer payment, get them on board. And the same with getting a board of advisors. I think that's another thing that it is never too soon to do, because all of those people add gravitas, skills, experience, open doors that give investors a lot more confidence than just sort of, you know, little old you, you know, which makes them nervous sometimes. So yeah, great advice.
The board of advisors is also another one, isn't it? Because again, it's like finding somebody, it's not as permanent as a co-founder, but it's finding somebody that you can have a really strong relationship with, and it's finding people that are prepared or able to give you the level of commitment you really want. So I think it can be very easy to think, oh great, they want to be my advisor, that's amazing, and then actually they haven't really got the time to give you what you need. So making sure that you don't just think, you have to say yes to everybody that shows an interest in becoming an advisor. You've got to take it really seriously and think about what it is you want, and be really direct. So, you know, can you commit this amount of time? Will you come to this number of meetings with me? And really sort of pinning them down on that, because otherwise I think you can end up being really disappointed that you're just not getting the sort of level of response you thought you would get from this person who sounded really excited about what you're doing.
Yeah. And also I think it's really important that, you know, I have seen founders sort of putting a board of advisors together for the purposes of a pitch deck that aren't really doing that much in the business. So I agree with you, they've got to be genuine, and I think you've got to pick them carefully, and you need to find a way to make it a proper commitment on both parts.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I have to say, I really, really wish you all the very best with getting this round closed. It's a super exciting concept. And so what are you going to do with all the money?
It's the big raise or the small raise. the intention now is to continue the tech roadmap. So there's quite a lot of exciting stuff we want to build into the platform that really starts to move it forward, to get the team properly in place. So, you know, I've got these women, but I want to be able to properly get them on board and pay them properly, and then to really focus on marketing. So we need to make people aware that we exist, so we need a bit of marketing spend behind it. Yeah, that's the plan.
Great. Well, I wish you all the best. It's a fantastic endeavor, and it looks like you're having lots of fun doing it. So
that's what I would say is that I have learned more in the last 2 years than I learned in the last 20 years. It's been such a brilliant learning curve, and it's really exciting. You know, the sort of conversations you have with people, it's a whole new world. It's brilliant. I wouldn't have changed it for anything. But it's bloody hard, much harder than I expected.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. Really appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Gail. Thanks for following Fundraising Stories with Female Founders. This content is all provided to you for free. So if you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe so you never miss another one. Enter the Arena has helped hundreds of female founders fly through pre-raise and investment and onto the exponential growth of their business. Our first-hand experience, expert guidance, and proven programs help female founders unleash the Wonder Woman inside. To see if we can help you do the same, head over to www.enterthearena.co.uk. I'm Julia Elliott-Brown, and I look forward to talking with you soon.